Daniel chapter 1, let's read verses 1 through 7. In the first year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar's king of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles of the temple of God. Then he carried off to the temple of his god in Babylonia and put it in the treasure to the house of his god. Then the king ordered Aspenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical deficit, handsome, showing aptitude in every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. When Don called on Wednesday and said that he had to go out, he said, "We've got three options. You can preach, Scott can preach, or we can get somebody new. But it's a privilege to preach." So after talking over with Scott, and he said he'll bring the message next week, I said I'll bring it this week. But it's kind of a quick notice. I figured I had a couple messages that I could bring. One would be on Fathers and Father's Day, since it is Father's. The other, though, is, you know, if this was the last time I got to address the whole church, a message from Scriptures that God says, here's something to really pay attention to. The last time I did this, I was in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 12 to 14, and there Peter says, I'm going to tell you these things even though you already know them, just so you remember them. So even after I'm gone, you'll remember them. So in other words, pay attention. And throughout that section there, he goes to the word knowledge and says, knowledge will cause you to do things. Knowledge will cause you to act. Knowledge of who God is, what his will is, will allow you to obey and to do things. And that knowledge is what we're trying to pass on. What's God doing? What do we need to do? Knowledge of God's will. As a father, I find my role kind of shifting from raising little kids and being a teacher now to being one of an advisor. The kids are off to college. They want to know, where should they go to school? How do you pick a college? What kind of career should they have? What's the direction? Some of the kids are getting out of college and they're looking around and they're going, well, where do I look for a job? I'm looking in this city. I'm looking in other cities that are out of state. How do I decide what I should take? And I haven't been bugged too much about the boyfriend-girlfriend issue, but I know it's down the road, and I know I'm going to be asked about that. So what kind of advice do you give as a father? What kind of direction do you want to give them? As a father, when I see my kids following the Lord, making the right decisions, it's the happiest thing you can experience. But on the flip side is when they don't follow, you have a tendency to look at yourself and go, where did I screw up? What did I do? Didn't I teach them right? And you have a tendency to kind of bring that back on yourself. But what do you tell them? How do you direct them? We want to direct them on the right path, and we want them to say, find God's will and follow it. So God's will is kind of the subject that I'm picking up with. And the illustration I'm going to use is Daniel, who's not a dad at all. So if you can follow me through this, we'll end up where we need to end up. Let's turn to Romans chapter 12. Let's read verses 1 and 2. Romans 12, verse 1 says, therefore, I urge you, brethren, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. That's a challenge for each one of us. That's a challenge for us as fathers. Here is how you test God's will. Here's how you find it. Here's what you do. But this section starts with a therefore. The epistles aren't narratives. They don't tell stories in the epistles. Paul goes and he presents doctrine. And in Romans, we have 11 chapters of doctrine. And then he does life application and shows how you take this doctrine now and start applying it to your daily lives. And so the therefore is based upon everything that he's covered so far in his first chapter 11. And the urgency that I talked about with is, he says, I urge you, therefore, brethren. He has been building the case that God, through his mercy, has come down and he's declared us righteous. He's justified us. He has caused us to be at peace with himself. He's freed us from condemnation. He's given us his Holy Spirit. He's chosen us. He's called us. We're kept. We're secure. All this because of the mercy he decided to show upon us. So he says, because of those mercies, offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing. The response that God asks for us based upon all that he does is obedience. We owe God this obedience to live in a way that is pleasing. And he asks us to get on the altar. We're living sacrifices, not dead ones, not ones that are tied up. He says, put yourself on the altar and it's holy and pleasing to him, holy, set aside, committed to doing what he says, committed to obeying, because that's what we owe him, obedience. Based on all he's done for us, we should obey him. Then he says, don't conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So don't be fit into the mold of the world, but rather be transformed by thinking about things in a different way. And here's where knowledge that Peter was talking about starts getting hooked in. How do we transfer our minds, renew our minds, if we don't know the Scriptures, if we don't know what God expects of us? And how do we do it if we don't know it? Well, we won't. And so Paul is telling us there to renew your mind. Once you start thinking about God and his will, you will start testing and approving what it is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. God's will, then, is kind of what I'm going to pick up and talk about. God's will is talked about in the Scriptures as first being a sovereign will. God is over everything. He's over a fallen world that has good and evil in it. We just experienced the loss of the McGills. God, though, in his sovereign will, works all that out to accomplish exactly what he wants it to accomplish. In other words, God wins. His will is known to him and him alone. We know the end of it, but a lot of times as it starts to unfold, it's a secret. We don't understand it until history is passed, and then we can say, oh, that's what he was doing. But it's to him alone, and ultimately it says God wins. So his sovereign will is how he causes events, how he allows evil to happen, but also how he brings everything into submission to end up exactly the way he wants it. If we flip over just one chapter in Romans chapter 11 and read verses 33 through 36, Paul ends with this doxology as he closes out this doctrinal section in the book of Romans. He says, oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable his judgments, his paths go beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord, who has given him or who has been his counselor, who has ever given to God should repay him. For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever and ever. So God's sovereign will is exactly what he wants to do. He accomplishes, he uses evil, he never causes evil, he doesn't tempt anyone. But he uses this life to test us and bring us to the exact point he wants to. So his sovereign will is one area. Another area of God's will is his moral will. It's the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments, how we should treat one another. It's God's ethical demands and how we are to believe and live our lives. And this is completely revealed. We don't have scriptures being added. We don't need to go to the Mormons, for example, and check out the books of the Mormons. We don't need to check out Islam and what they've added. His expectations are completely revealed in the scriptures. You have the Old Testament guidelines renewed in the New Testament. The only debate is, how do you apply them? And that's where the discussion takes on. But the expectations are there. So God isn't a mystery as far as how he wants us to behave towards him, towards one another, and what we should do. And this can be summed up in a couple words. Do what's right. That's God's moral will. God is very capable of redirecting our lives when we don't do it. He's the God who can take evil once again or sin in our lives and get us on the right course. But doing what's right is God's moral will summed up. So what I want to pass on to my kids then is, how do you do that? Okay? And in verse 2 of chapter 12, it says, don't conform any longer to the pattern of the world. Don't conform. As followers of Jesus Christ, we find ourselves now in another kingdom. You look around you and you see the visible world and everything that's here, and you go, well, that's something that I want. Satan, when in Sunday school is a little bit about this, what will a man give for his life? Satan's answer is, he'll give everything to gain life here. But this kingdom that we can see is a part of the kingdom of the world, the kingdom of darkness, and it ends. Followers of Jesus find themselves in another kingdom that's just as real, but you can't see it. It's a spiritual kingdom. Faith is our basis. We have to believe who God is and that he's a rewarder for those who believe him. And so this spiritual kingdom is one that goes on without end, that you can't see now, that is just as real, and it says, act this way because you're in this kingdom. It has to be possessed now in order, it has to be acted upon now in order to be realized later. But it looks out and says, there's a better world coming, so therefore act in a certain way. Now, what does Daniel have to do with this? Well, as an example of that first illustration, and you know, there was a whole bunch of sermons I listened to on God's will. I couldn't squeeze those all into one topic, so we're just going to pick up one aspect. And that's the idea of conformity. Do not conform to the pattern of this world. And for that, we're going to go back to Daniel. In 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 through 13, let's flip over there just real quick. 1 Corinthians 10, 1 through 13. Paul says, I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud. They all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They ate the same spiritual food, drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them, and their bodies were scattered over the desert. Now, these things occurred as examples for us, to keep us from setting our hearts on evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as was written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in pagan revelry. We should not commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 of them died. We should not test the Lord as some of them did and were killed by snakes, and do not grumble as some of them did and were killed by the destroying angel. These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, for whom the fullness of the age have come. Old Testament stories, Old Testament examples are there for us to pay attention to learn from, and to not to repeat what they did wrong, but to repeat what they did right. And in Daniel's case, that's what we're going to be looking at. I've heard that you get New Testament principles from the epistles, from the gospel, and then you look for illustrations of them back in the Old Testament to explain them, kind of put flesh on what the idea is. And that's what the book of Daniel does for this passage. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So, let's flip over back to Daniel. Daniel is a captive. He's been deported. He lives in a time when the kingdom of Judah has come to its final days. The kingdom of Israel, which was composed of 10 tribes that split off from the nation Israel, you had the kingdom of Israel and you had the kingdom of Judah, had been removed years earlier by Assyria. Judah had a king named Hezekiah, who had realized what was happening. God delivered the nation. And Daniel comes from probably the line of Hezekiah. He is in the lines of probably Josiah, because it says that these were parts of the royal family and nobility that the Israelites had been taken captive and brought back to serve in the king's court. Nebuchadnezzar did that, I think, for a couple reasons. One is they're almost like a ransom. So if you don't behave back in Judah, your family members are back in Babylon. Something bad could happen to them. And it also removes the ruling class and the leading class, so the chances of a revolt are less. But Daniel finds himself in Babylon without a kingdom to go back to. He's a captive. He's been removed from his family. And he has basically lost it all. Judah is about to be destroyed. And it said that in verse 1 and 2 that Nebuchadnezzar also took articles from the temple, carried them off, and put them in his temple and his treasury. Once again, a symbol of the defeat of the nation. There's nothing for Daniel to go back to. He has been removed. And the question that Daniel has is, does God have a future? The nation's gone. Everything that he had associated with the temple service, the worship, all gone. His family's gone. What kind of a future does he as an individual, do his people have now that there isn't a physical kingdom there? So will God bless? Will God take care of the individual now that he doesn't? And the pressure on Daniel is going to be conform to the courts of the Babylonians. Everything that they want to press on him, they want him to accept. They want him to leave. And that is the challenge that Daniel is facing. As Daniel questions, what's the future of Israel's God? If you scan the book, you see a whole series of miracles and visions and dreams that basically convey God is sovereign over all the affairs of man and that he hasn't lost control at all. That kingdoms are going to rise and fall, yet God is going to sovereignly make things for Israel and for his people the way he's always promised, and demonstrates that God is sovereign over all the earth. History is in his hands, and history is in God's control. So that as Daniel prophesied in vision, those who look later said he couldn't have possibly done that. He had to have history in order to accurately write down what he did. Of course, those people don't accept divine inspiration. But that's the only way they can explain it. Because the God, the sovereign God of the universe, is in control. So Daniel ends up proving and demonstrating that God is indeed sovereign. Daniel's personal story is a story of the commitment and the dedication to God that we read about there in Romans chapter 12, verse 2. Putting himself on the altar and not conforming to the wishes and the demands that his new state in life brought him. He's in the temple. Daniel, as he writes those first verses, is bringing to mind that when a nation conquered another nation, they looked at it as their gods were stronger than the nation they just conquered, and that their gods were superior. So that, for example, in Isaiah chapter 36, let's flip over there real quick, the king of Assyria, named Sennacherib, he's the king of Assyria, is reading a letter out loud to the people in Jerusalem that are behind the walls. And in chapter 36, verses 18 through 20, we see the illustration of what Daniel is experiencing here in Babylonia. The king says, "Don't let Hezekiah mislead you when he says, 'The Lord will deliver us.' Has the God of any nation ever delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath, Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharim? Have they rescued Samaria from my hand? Who of all the gods of these countries has been able to save his land from me? How then can the Lord deliver Jerusalem out of his hand?" Daniel's case, the Lord hadn't. So his kingdom's fallen. Are the gods of Babylon stronger than the God of Judah? And Daniel has to decide what he's going to do. His name is changed as the Babylonians try to strip away his identity and change it from "you're serving El, God," to "now you're going to serve the gods of Babylon." And the other individuals are also changed in their name as they completely try to strip away what these young kids have. Now, Daniel, historians say, is probably about 15 years old. You can imagine Ryan, maybe Christian, suddenly being carted off into a foreign land. Can they stand? Can they keep their faith? Recently, I was just thinking, there was an illustration of possibly what Daniel was going through when, you remember, the two reporters got captured from the New York Times. And the Muslim extremists had them. They eventually released them. But they had to convert to Islam. They were getting their dull knives out. They were ready to do a head job on them. And these individuals said, "Oh, no, we'll convert." That's kind of what Daniel is facing in this scenario, as he is called upon to conform to the pattern that is set before him, and he has got to start making a choice. But Daniel isn't raised that way. Two kings before Jehoiakim, they had found the book of the law. And Josiah had led reforms, had read it, and it says they celebrated a Passover that hadn't been celebrated like that since the days of the judges. And Daniel, 15, probably takes a little bit of part in that reform. But he knows what God's requirements are when it comes to a dietary regulations. He understands that. And he, once again, has that knowledge that we were talking about, that Peter talks about. God expects obedience to this. The question is, will I obey? Will I crawl on that altar as a living sacrifice and obey? So, first we see that obedience to God, in Daniel's case, is going to demand that he does not conform to the Babylonian edicts. Let's read in verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, And he asked the chief's official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now, God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid for my lord the king who has assigned you your food should see you looking worse than the other young men of your age, and he would then have my head because of you." This is a serious situation for him. This official could lose his head. Daniel could lose his head. And Daniel needs, once again, a sovereign God to work on his behalf. But Daniel resolves in his mind. Remember Romans 12:1-2 said, transform your mind by, I forget what it says, by renewing your thoughts. Think about the world in light of what Daniel knows. God says, obey and you'll be blessed. Disobey, you will be punished. And that was the covenant that Israel had seen, that Judah had seen. And so he decides he's going to obey. He changes his mind. He resolves in his mind that he's going to do that. He transforms it. And therefore, he won't conform to the demands that the Babylonians are putting. But it could cost him his life. But God sovereignly blesses him in verse 9. The result is, in verse 15 and 17, that God blesses him. So let's look at that real quick. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. For these young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the set time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah as they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters of his whole kingdom. So God is responding. God is blessing. Daniel's chosen to obey no matter the consequences. And God is blessing his word. He's blessing them, and he is helping them. He's given them gifts. Now, obedience to God will demand allegiance to him and him alone. You cannot be, and this is what Paul's been talking about all through Romans, you can't be partaking in the patterns and the deeds of the flesh. God's not mocked. What you reap, you're going to sow. You can't be partaking and living in this world of the kingdom of the world and then still claim to have allegiance to God. God demands total allegiance. So obedience to him is going to result in allegiance. Let's flip over to Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar has set up an idol, and he has declared that everyone is going to worship that idol, so that when they hear the signal, which was all kinds of musical instruments, everyone was supposed to bow down and worship that idol. And anyone who doesn't is going to be thrown into a blazing furnace. Now, Daniel's three friends are the subject of the story here, the narrative. We don't know where Daniel is, if he's off on official business or if he was sick or where he's at. But this is the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we start picking up with the exchange in verse 13. It's brought to the attention of the king that these three will not bow down and worship the image. So, in verse 13, furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summons Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods nor worship the image of gold that I set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, and all these musical instruments, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue me from my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it. And he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, We want you to know, O King, that we will not serve your gods nor worship your image of gold that you have set up. They refused to conform. And they said, our allegiance is to God and God alone. We don't need to defend him. He's capable of defending himself. We're going to do this as a result of that. We basically make a bet with our lives when we choose to follow Christ and his kingdom. We're betting that what he says is more real than anything the world has to offer us out there. College kids, career choices, you're betting your life as you choose to follow who Jesus is, what he said, that is more real than what it is the world's telling you to try and to do. So you make a bet with your lies that it's real. Let's finish that story then. Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace was so hot that the flames killed the soldiers who took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, were there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire? They said, certainly, O king. He said, look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound, unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar then shouted through the opening of the blazing furnace and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. The satraps, the prefects, the governors, the royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair on their head singed, and their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. God acted on their behalf. In the stories in Daniel, we see that God and God's will becomes more apparent to us, more clear, when it seems like we're deserted and defeated. That's when, in reality, we start paying attention more. What is going on? How do I deliver myself from this dilemma? Well, turning to God is the answer, following him. And with the diet, God gave them, of obedience, the gift of interpreting dreams and visions, which Daniel then used to save the lives of him and other counselors a couple times. Idol worship, God gave them deliverance from the fiery furnace. There's one more scene in Daniel where he is thrown into a lion's den. And once again, God sends an angel and delivers him from that. So, nonconformity, it was what obedience called for and how God acted on the part of Daniel and his friends. The testimony of nonconformity, obedience to God, and the resulting blessing leads into testimony of praise and blessing by those who observe it and by unbelievers and those around them. Let's look at the testimony of Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 2 of Daniel, let's look at 46 and 47. This is after Daniel has told him about his dream that he didn't even remember. And God had given Daniel that gift of being able to understand visions and dreams. In 46 and 47, King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel, paid him honor in order that an offering of incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, surely, your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings, the revealer of mysteries, and you are able to reveal this mystery. So as a result of Daniel telling King Nebuchadnezzar's dream, his testimony is that. He blesses God and he gives him the glory and the honor. In Daniel chapter 3, at the end of the fiery furnace. Daniel chapter 3, 28 and 29. Nebuchadnezzar says, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than to serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decreed that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way. Flip over to Daniel chapter 4, verses 34 through 37. Nebuchadnezzar has been driven to insanity until he acknowledges that the Most High reigns supreme. And at the end of this time period, he does that. In 34 through 37, he says, "At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes towards heaven. My sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified Him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His king endures from generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as He pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back His hand or say to Him, 'What have you done?'" Now, Nebuchadnezzar had had those experiences. The Babylonians fall. The next kingdom that comes in are the Persians and the Medes. And Daniel has also dealings with them. He's thrown in lion pit. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 6 and read the testimony of King Darius, a Persian now, as he gets to witness Daniel's refusal to conform and bend when it came to the matter of prayer and worship of idols once again. Let's read 19 and 20, and then 26 through 28. "At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called out to Daniel in an anguished voice, 'Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God who you serve continually be able to rescue you from the lions?' Daniel answered, 'O king, live forever. My God sent his angel. He shut the mouths of the lion. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I done anything wrong before you, O king.'" The king's response then is in 26 through 28. "I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is a living God and he endures forever. His kingdom will never be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." Standing for God, choosing to not conform but to be transformed, yielded a blessing. And the testimony that these pagans are given are what you would expect from a Christian, from somebody who's gone through it. You'd expect that kind of testimony from Daniel. But that nonconformity led them to declare what they declared. The Persians allowed the nation Israel to come back into the land. And it talked in Chronicles about how some of the kings that had been put in prison were released because they liked the Jews, the Israelites, because of Daniel. The Magi that came to see Jesus came from the Far East, Babylonia. Had Daniel's influence extended that far? Daniel, choosing to live the way he lived, yielded great blessing for lots of generations after that and for the people. How does this relate to Father's Day? Well, Daniel was taught by his parents, probably by the priest that went through the Reformation. Could our kids stand in the same way as young teenagers, completely removed from our homes and that? It's a testimony to the good job that his parents did do with him and the lessons that they taught him. So, don't be conformed. I'll leave you with a few questions. Do you always try to fit in? When you're with your friends and you're out away from your family and from your contacts, even us adults, when we're away from everything that we know, we're on a trip, do you try to fit in? Do you see what you can do to, be as much like anybody else as you can? Can you stand alone? Nonconformity is going to require that you stand alone and do what God's told you to do. Will your values reflect your belief that there is another kingdom? Are you making your choices based upon the reality that there is a kingdom that is just as real as that chair that you can see right there, and that we will indeed face that? And would anybody want to catch what you got? Your life, your beliefs, are they appealing enough that somebody goes, he's different, but he's different in the good way? Are you making your choices there? One of the things that I didn't do was give myself a clothing. So I think what we'll do is we'll just go back and let's read Romans 12, 1 and 2. Keep Daniel in mind. And Romans 12, 1 and 2. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will.